Welcome to Raw Talk on M88. Call in with your questions or comments. Toll free 1-866-730-4921. Or submit your question to Dear DJ at M88.org.
And welcome to Raw Talk here on M88. I'm your host, Yo. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Also want to say thank you real quick to everyone who came out this past Friday to the Albuquerque Christian Children's Home and helped us out with the work project we had going on out there. We painted a couple sheds. Sanded, refinished some benches, which I've never done before. I've never sanded or refinished anything before, so I felt pretty handy figuring that out. But we got a lot of work done. The maintenance guy out there at the Christian Children's Home said we saved him 3 weeks worth of work, so appreciate everyone who came out and helped out. We had people from lots of different churches come out and help us out, and that was a big blessing to me, and I know it was a big blessing to the Children's Home, so thank you guys for doing that. And speaking of serving the community, this coming Friday, we're going to head down to the Albuquerque Rescue Mission. Serve breakfast again out there at the homeless shelter. And if you'd like to be a part of that, as always, send us an email, studio@m88.org. Well, I am excited about tonight's topic. And everyone that I've told throughout this past week, hey, what are you doing for Raw Talk? And I tell them, oh, we're going to talk about pain, grief, suffering, and sorrow. They always gave me like a weird look. Like, why would you want to talk about that? I don't get it. Why would you be excited about that kind of show? Well, as I was thinking about this, I was thinking, you know what? I don't know if we want to acknowledge it or not, but pain, suffering, sorrow, grief, it's a big part of life. I don't know if you've experienced any of it, but I know I have. And quite frankly, some very troubling questions come up in those times of grief and sorrow. Some what we might consider dark questions, questions that we don't really want to voice out loud. Like, we as Christians can't ever say certain questions when grief comes around. And quite frankly, I think sometimes we treat God like a big old Band-Aid. And tonight I want to talk about how God is more than just a Band-Aid in our times of grief, pain, sorrow, and suffering. And tonight we have a very special guest, Nancy Guthrie, joining us. She has written a book called Hearing Jesus Speak Into Your Sorrow. You might not think it's the most uplifting title you've ever heard, but man, it's so important. And I don't know about you, but I would love to hear Jesus speak into my times of sorrow and grief, one of which is really, really recent for me. And we'll get into that in just a moment. But Nancy, thank you so much for joining us tonight here on Raw Talk. Really appreciate you sharing your time this evening.
Hey, yo, I'm glad to be with you and your listeners.
Well, Nancy, you have an amazing story about how you've had to face grief and suffering. And I got to tell you, first of all, thank you for being bold enough and honest enough to get out there and share that story. I know it cannot be easy to share your particular story. When I heard you talking about it, it reminded me of a few episodes in my life where I, not quite the same, but where I had similar moments of grief that, quite frankly, I wouldn't want to share with anybody. But I really appreciate you being so honest about your story and being willing to share it. You have an amazing story, and I think an amazing ministry, because quite frankly, people don't like talking about this topic of grief. I don't know if you've noticed that.
I have noticed that, yeah.
And why do you think it is that even Christians are somewhat averse to discussing this topic of sorrow, grief, and suffering?
Well, I think some of it is we don't want to talk about it. You know, if we haven't been there, we don't want to talk about it because we're kind of superstitious.
Mm.
You know, like, oh, gee, if I talk about grief, if I talk about death, then maybe I'll have to go through it. You know, maybe that will, especially if I express any resistance to it, you know, then maybe God will make me.
Right.
We kind of are suspicious about God, that he is out to make our lives miserable and rather than out to bless us. And so I sometimes think that's why it is. But, you know, yo, the other thing is grief is awkward. Mm. To be around someone who's grieving is awkward. To talk about their grief is awkward. To be the person who's grieving is awkward. Maybe that's another reason we kind of avoid it, because we're afraid we're going to say the wrong thing to someone who's hurting. If we're the one who's hurting, we know people will say some things that might bother us. We're uncomfortable with our tears, and we're afraid we might burst out in tears. So maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, well, that's definitely true. It is an awkward topic, and yet it seems to me it's a very important one, and one that we as Christians should grab hold of, because if there's anyone who can speak into grief and sorrow, it should be the person who's walking with Christ. And yet we still have, I don't know, we're still weird about it. Before we start talking more specific about some of this stuff, if you don't mind, would you share your experience with grief and sorrow, your particular story that made you get to the point where you wrote the book Holding On to Hope, and now your new one, Hearing Jesus Speak Into Your Sorrow. Would you mind sharing your journey on this dark path?
I'm happy to.
All right.
Yeah, it was about 10 years ago that my husband and I and our son Matt, who was 8 at the time, headed to the hospital for me to give birth to our daughter, Hope. And when Hope was born, what was immediately noticeable was that she had club feet. And, of course, the doctor said, well, don't worry about that. That's no big deal. We can take care of that. But he did say, you know, you're going to want to have the pediatrician really look over her closely. And when our pediatrician came that day and then came to my room that night, he had a piece of paper in his hand where he had made a list. And he said, you know, I've made a list of a number of little things wrong with Hope. He said, you know, she does have club feet. She's very lethargic. She's a little underweight. She's got a real large soft spot and a flat chin and some extra skin on her neck. He said, you know, it's not that those things are necessarily bad, but a lot of times when there are a number of little things wrong, they add up to something bigger. And so I want to have a geneticist come and take a look at her. And so her second day, a geneticist from Vanderbilt came over and examined her, and he came to our room that night and closed the door. And he said that he suspected Hope had a rare metabolic disorder called Zellweger syndrome, something that we had never heard of before. And he explained that Hope was missing this tiny subcellular particle, a little enzyme that you and I have in every cell of our bodies. And the best way I know how to explain it is that these enzymes kind of have one job. They're like the trash man for the cells. And their one job is to rid the cells of long-chain fatty acids. And he explained that Hope was missing these tiny peroxisomes in her cells. And because of that, there was nobody to take out the trash. And that meant that those long-chain fatty acids would build up in her cells and become toxic. And that over time, that would cause all of her major organs to shut down. And he told us that there was no treatment and no cure, and that most children with the syndrome live less than 6 months. And I remember that night, you know, he left and David crawled into bed with me and we cried, and we cried out to God, you know, God help us. I mean, what are we going to do with this? I mean, we want to trust you with this, but what does that even look like? And what is ahead for us? And the reality of Hope's life was that her first day was her best. And it was kind of downhill from there. At 3 months, she developed seizures, and we had to begin to medicate her heavily for those. She wasn't able to suck, and so we fed her with a tube, and then eventually a feeding tube in her stomach. But also, along with those hard things, I would also say that the time we had with Hope was rich and wonderful, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. It was kind of scary and, of course, sad, but it was also rich and wonderful because there's something really special when you know life is short, that you really make the most of it. And we did that. We had a birthday party for her every month because I knew she wouldn't reach her first birthday. And those were special times with friends and families that we'll just never forget. And maybe most significantly, the conversation changed in our lives. You know, you go from going out in the yard and talking to your neighbors about the lawn or sports. Then the conversation became life and death and faith and healing and questions. And that made life rich to talk about things that were so meaningful. And I told you we had a birthday party every month. I remember we were coming up at what would be a six-month party, and there was a part of me that just didn't want to have a party because at that point she was really not in good shape, and it seemed almost ridiculous, like denying reality to have a party to celebrate her life. But it also felt like a significant milestone that we had made it that far. And so we had a big party in the park near our home. But I remember driving home from that party saying to my husband, David, I don't think we'll have a seven-month party. Mm-hmm. And it was a couple of weeks later that we got up in the middle of the night, and David went to check on Hope, and she was cold to the touch, and she was gone. And, you know, those had been such an intense 6 months, and I think there was a part of me that thought that since I had had those 6 months to prepare for her death, that maybe my grief after her death would be lighter. I certainly hoped it might work that way. But I don't think it did work that way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, while we had had this rich, meaningful, full time while she was with us, then she was just gone, you know? And I felt such a deep emptiness and loneliness and grief set in hard, I would say, on us.
And then your story continues after that, as if that wasn't enough. And
yeah.
I know right now people are already thinking, wow, that's heavy. I'm waiting for the happy ending where, you know, where God comes along, says, sorry about that. Oh,
yeah.
Here's something nice for you. But I think the thing that strikes me most about your story is that happy ending didn't happen quite the way people might think, or at least it hasn't happened yet. And I want to get to the yet later, but why don't you continue what happens next?
Well, to have a child with that syndrome means that both parents are carriers of the recessive gene trait for it. So, you know, if you remember from your high school biology class what it took for a child to have blue eyes.
Yeah, vaguely I remember.
Yeah, both parents, you know, carry the recessive gene trait, then any time they have a child, that child has a 25% chance of having the blue eyes. And so once we had a child with Zellweger syndrome, then we knew that both my husband and I must be carriers. We didn't know before that,
right.
But then we knew. And so, you know, then, we just faced this difficult decision of, do we take that chance again, having another child? And, you know, to you and your listeners, it might seem really easy. For some people, just, you know, absolutely not. You know, who could risk going through such a hard thing again? And yet, you know, our time with Hope was so precious. I mean, she was such a gift to us. We loved her, and we enjoyed her. And so it wasn't a quick, no, we would never do that again. But our life isn't just us. And, you know, we considered our son, Matt, like I said, who was 8 at the time, and who experienced the trauma of having a sibling who died and having a very sad mom and dad for a while. But probably even more than that was our parents. As hard as it is to lose a child, I think there's something doubly difficult for parents to watch their child lose a child.
Yeah.
And it had been so painful for our parents. And so we took surgical steps to prevent another pregnancy. Now, I have to tell you, by the way, that a while ago, I was telling this with my husband. We were up in front of a group of people, and I got to that point. I said that, and he leaned in, and he said, we? Because, you know, you men, you want a lot of credit for that. But anyway.
Well, it is kind of a big deal.
It's
that's more raw than I want to get right now.
Okay.
But, let's just say I've gone through the same thing, so I can identify with his pain.
Yeah. You know, we've taken care of that.
Yeah.
So you can imagine how shocked, to put it mildly, we were to discover about a year and a half after Hope died that I was pregnant.
Mm.
But the truth is, we weren't just shocked. We were afraid. You know, at that point, I felt like I was just beginning to get my bearings again after losing Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And to think, okay, so will this child hit those healthy 75% odds like our son Matt? Or will we perhaps hit those 25% odds and go through this again. And that was really scary, just wondering, can I do that? And we, that geneticist who had diagnosed Hope, we'd stayed in touch with him, and he had told us that he can could test very early. And, of course, him telling us he could test very early, he had said, don't take any permanent birth control steps because we can test early. And, of course, what he was saying was, you know, we can test early and then take care of that.
Mm-hmm.
And while we knew that we would continue the pregnancy no matter what, we were kind of glad to know there was a test that would let us know, because we felt like it would be so helpful throughout the pregnancy to know which way it was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to wait a number of weeks till I could take the test, and then another number of weeks before we got the results. And then finally that day came when the geneticist called and said that he'd had the results, and that this child, a boy this time, would also be born with Zellweger syndrome.
Mm.
And so it was 8 years ago this week that our son, Gabriel, was born. And, you know, his life and his death was very similar to Hope. He was with us, whereas she was with us 199 days, he was with us 183. And we loved and enjoyed him. He was such a gift to us. And such a statement to us and to the world about God's sovereignty in our lives.
Hmm.
And also God's sufficiency in our lives, because we experienced a great deal of both.
Yeah. You know, I have to say that once you hear your story, there's probably some people thinking, wow, how do you still believe in God anymore? I mean, when I was going through college, even in high school, you know, I came across some hard moments that, you know, gave me pause. Like, okay, do I really believe that God is around in the midst of something like this? And I know for a fact from the people that I knew in college and high school that they would encounter something so horrific that they would just flat say, I can't believe in a God who allows suffering like this to happen. And so, you know, the question naturally occurs to me, how do you still believe in God after going through all of that?
Well, I think the question has some presuppositions behind it.
True enough.
Okay?
Yep.
So the presupposition is that it's God's job to keep me from suffering. That if he's lucky enough to get me to choose him... I want to be in his family. Then some kind of guarantee kicks in, or he owes me somehow, and what he owes me is a comfortable, pain-free life.
Mm.
So I think what you're talking about, which is very real, that sense in which how could God do this? And if he does allow something like this in my life, then I'm going to be mad at him, reject him, turn away from him. It really does have that presupposition of he owes me. And he has wronged me, and that he's responsible for this. So, you know, probably the most significant thing that I had to deal with pretty early on was that sense of figuring out where the blame lies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people do so quickly and so freely. When something hard happens, they just say, I'm so mad at God, and we feel very free to be angry with him.
But, well, doesn't that feed back into, like, our whole belief in God's sovereignty? I mean, I hear so often people say, well, God is sovereign, and that means that everything that comes into your life has been allowed by God, and he's allowed it for a purpose, and you know, that's what we're taught, that's what we're instructed in so often, so that when we encounter that, you know, it sounds all good when nothing's happening. Like, oh, okay, cool, God's sovereign, he's taking care of my life, sweet. But then when we encounter something like that you've gone through, well, that makes it much harder to go along with what we've been taught.
I know it did for me, yo.
Yeah.
I mean, what that required of me was to dig deep in God's word. I mean, it drove me to God's word to go, okay, God, this, I don't know how to put this together.
Hmm.
Because how do I balance your sovereign control of this world and of my life, and with also this understanding that you love me.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you love me and you're sovereignly in control of my life, how do I put those things together? And I would say that you have to have both of those things. If we only have this view that God is sovereign, but no sense that he loves us, then we're angry.
Mm-hmm.
Or if we have this only the sense that he loves us, but he's not sovereign, then we rob him of the essence of who he is. And we also, that leaves us floundering in a sense of, yeah, he loves me, but he had no power over this. Well, who could commit their life to a God who has no control, no authority over our lives, no ordaining of the circumstances of our lives? So, to have one without the other doesn't work. And so I think the way it's worked for me is it's that my confidence in his love for me is what has allowed me to accept his sovereignty in my life. And by that I mean that because I do believe he is sovereign, that he has ordained the days of my life, that every day of my life, this is the way David wrote it in Psalm 139, every day of my life was written in your book before one of them came to be. And the reason I can be okay with that is because I do believe he loves me, and that he is... But that his love for me is not a commitment to my comfort. It is an active commitment to my ultimate good. God is at work in my life, purifying me, preparing me, and even better than that, using me to put his character and work on display for the world. I mean, what an amazing thing that the God of the universe would entrust putting his glory on display in the world through us as believers, but he does. Mm. And we want him to do that through our successes and through our goodness. We want to have these successful, beautiful lives and just think, oh, the world looks at me and sees how good God is because my life is so good. And the reality is that God chooses to put his work in the world on display, not through the successes and good things in our life, but through the broken places in our lives. Mm. That's where God does his best shining forth. And the way he does that is that believers like you and me, go through hard things, and the world is watching. And they're watching to see, will he get mad at God? Will she get mad at God and walk away when the hard things happen? Or will we actually see that Jesus is so precious, so reliable, so trustworthy to them that they, in fact, draw closer to God, that there's a new sweetness in their faith, and that they value Jesus in their lives more than their own comfort.
Hmm.
I mean, that is a powerful witness to the world.
Yeah, it's one the world doesn't quite get either, because comfort is king. We're talking with Nancy Guthrie, author of the book Hearing Jesus Speak Into Your Sorrow. And if you got some questions about this topic, and I'd be shocked if no one did, because it's something that, again, we don't talk a lot about, but I know for a fact we've all experienced it, and we've had questions about this. Here's a great time to ask them if you are bold enough. You can give us a call at 1-866-730-4921, toll free, no matter where you are. You can call in. We actually have Samantha on the line right now. Samantha, welcome to Raw Talk. What do you have to say, Samantha?
Hi, how are you guys doing?
So far, so good.
Hey, Samantha.
I just want to tell you, Nancy, that your strength is amazing. I can't even put it to words. It amazes me how you've pulled through. And I wanted to say, too, that I know I've had some struggles of my own, and I've realized now, later on, that God puts sometimes problems in our way like that to help strengthen our faith and to make us stronger.
Absolutely.
Hey, Samantha, how old are you?
15. Well, just turned 16 a couple days ago.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
No problem. And Samantha, I'm so glad that you called in. because I wanted to ask you, how do you think Nancy's story relates to you? Hearing something about like what Nancy has gone through, how does that encourage you as a young teenager, invincible, the best of life before you, you don't have any care in the world? I mean, how does this relate to you?
Well, it relates to me, I think, in how she's suffered. I've not lost a sibling and stuff, but I've made some pretty stupid decisions of my own, and I've made my family suffer for them. And I've seen the pain that it causes, and it just, it kind of reminded me of the pain that I've seen others go through, similar to mine, because it caused me pain when I saw my family suffer.
Well, Samantha, I'm so glad you called in and we're willing to share, and I'm really grateful you're listening tonight.
Thank you.
No problem. You have a great evening, okay, Samantha?
You too.
All right.
Bye, and Samantha.
If you'd like to call in like Samantha did and share a comment or ask a question, 1-866-730-4921, toll-free number, 1-866-730-4921. And Nancy, I'm so glad Samantha called in because, you know, she illustrated kind of what I had as a gut feeling when I first heard you talking about that, that pain and grief is a universal problem regardless of our age. And It's important that we start teaching our kids how to face it, because, and you can correct me if you've seen a different, perception of this. It kind of seems sometimes the way that we handle this as a body, as the church, is that we don't talk much about it, like you said, because it's awkward. We don't want to depress people until something happens. And then we slap God on that pain like a Band-Aid and tell people to buck up and get over it because God loves them. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that if we prepare people early on, even when they're kids, you are going to face pain. You are going to face grief. Here is how you can turn to God in those moments. It seems that might be a better approach than waiting until something happens and slapping God on as a Band-Aid afterward.
Yeah. Well, I think it even goes deeper than that, perhaps, just in that sense that we have to be careful when we call people to turn toward Christ, that we're not calling people, that we're not doing a sales job where we're suggesting Jesus as someone whom they can consume, like we are consumers of so many other services.
Right, yeah.
And, a lot of us, quite frankly, have come to Christ as consumers, and we kind of think it is, his job to take care of all the problems for us. And, we've got our list of prayer requests, and we put in our order with him. And there's that sense, rather than seeing our lives as that, rather than seeing the glory of who God is, the amazing, stunning glory of who God is in the center, the overriding center, and our lives revolving around him, we tend to see ourselves in the center, and that Jesus is hovering around us waiting to fix our problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when those problems come, if he doesn't do that, we think, well, what good was Jesus anyway? there's that sense, and we don't pursue him for him, but just for what he can do for us. And so I think it is good as a young believer, as you're growing in your faith, to ask yourself, is this all about getting God to be on my side, to help me, to fix my problems, to answer my prayers? Or am I so convinced and amazed at the beauty and sufficiency of Jesus Christ and who he is? Have I so saturated myself in who the scriptures tell me he is? Has he become so beautiful and so compelling to me that I want him? I want to know him. I want to hide myself him. I want him to be the foundation of my life. I want my life to revolve around him. Or is it that sense of, I kind of want to be associated with Jesus, and I want to keep him handy for when I need him. I mean, that's the big difference. And I think that's the big crucible that all of us in our lives come to. And I think incredible suffering is where the rubber meets the road in our lives.
Yeah.
It's where it's all put to the test. In fact, I used those words that morning after Hope's diagnosis. My pastor came to see me in the hospital. And I just looked at him and I said, you know what, Charles? I think here's where the rubber meets the road in my life. Mm-hmm. And here's where I'm going to find out if I really believe everything I've said I believe my whole life.
It seems because so often we put Christ into a glass case and break glass only in a case of emergency.
Isn't that true?
Yeah.
How sad. Here's this. It's just a travesty that we would use him that way rather than enjoy him. He's offered himself to us to enjoy. And we think that the real enjoyment is apart from him. And that's the tragedy.
Yeah. Now I totally lost my train of thought while I was listening to you. Sorry about that. Oh, we're talking with Nancy Guthrie, author of Hearing Jesus Speak Into Your Sorrow. And I remember where I was going to go now, Nancy. There was a couple points in your book where I got to some of the things that you said, and it was just kind of like a little slap upside my head. I'm like, oh, man, that hurt.
I didn't mean to slap you.
It's okay, because I needed it, because it hurt, but what you were saying was so true. And one of the things that really struck me, almost literally, was where you're talking about how our times of disappointment with God, really what we're saying in those moments is that our immediate comfort is more important than his eternal plan for our lives. That we're more concerned with our comfort in the here and now, and we don't really care that much about what God considers as our ultimate good. And when you pointed that out, because there's been lots of times I've been disappointed with God. You know, when I found out that my dad had Parkinson's, when I found out that my niece had cystic fibrosis, when, you know, my wife has some disease that no one can even diagnose. You know, I've had plenty of moments where I was disappointed with God, but when I read your statement there, I kind of felt guilty because I was thinking, yeah, I am kind of concerned about the comfort of the people that I love.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry about that, God. I do want your ultimate good for everyone's life, mine and my wife's and my dad's and my niece's. But that's a hard thing to get to.
Well, let me slap you on the side of his head again.
Yeah, please do.
Because
go right ahead. I need it.
Yeah, do you also remember reading where I asked the question, why doesn't anybody say when something bad happens, I am so mad at sin?
I loved that passage where you talked about where the blame lies. It's something that my wife and I have talked a lot about, and we discussed it exactly the same way you did, and I really enjoyed that part of your book.
Yeah, and just for your listeners, I mean, what I'm talking about is, you know, the cause of so much of our suffering, even though we're under God's sovereignty, the more relevant cause is this broken world we live in. You know, when Adam and Eve sinned, sin entered this world in a pervasive way. It permeated everything. It's like it's taken root and invaded everywhere. And, you know, so that means there are natural disasters and deadly viruses and, for me, defective genes. You know, and so, like, if you ask me why my husband and I have had two children with a fatal syndrome, my answer to you is that sin has so corrupted this world, it's corrupted even my genetic code. And so when we have a child who has died, we're living out the brokenness. We're experiencing the brokenness of the world. And, you know, because you and I are believers doesn't mean we're exempt from living in this world that is broken to the core because of the effects of sin. And so if we're looking to point blame, you know, rather than pointing the blame at the God who loves us and is actually seeking to do something good with, when I say that, you know, I'm not saying everything he allows into our lives is good, but the hope of the believer, the confidence only believers have, people in the world don't have it. As believers, we know that whatever God has allowed into our life, he intends to use it for our good. Doesn't mean it's good on its own, but he intends it to use it for good in our lives. So that's the amazing part of the sovereignty of God, is that even though you and I experience these hard things like cystic fibrosis and Parkinson's and Zellweger, we're experiencing the brokenness of this world. And the one we should be mad at, you know, the target of our anger should be sin. And, you know, we're not the only ones mad at sin.
Yeah.
I mean, who's the person who's most mad at sin? God himself, you know. And, in fact, he's not only mad at sin, planning to judge sin. He sent his son to break the curse of sin. That's the reason why Jesus came. Jesus took all of our sin upon himself. So that, and God poured out his wrath for sin on his own son to break the curse of sin. And he started a process in motion that's going to eradicate and totally reverse this curse that happened when sin entered the world. Now, the hard part for you and me, though, is we want that right now. We want that whole fulfillment of that eradication of that curse to be done.
Yep.
That's in the future. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in this in-between time. It's in-between time when he has, when Jesus took on the curse of sin and has paid the debt for it, and he has started this process. And, you know, it's not going to be complete until he comes again and he ushers in a new heaven and a new earth. And Revelation tells us that when that happens, there is no more curse. Hmm. There's no more sorrow. There's no more death. And we long for that day. But, you know, we can't try to press into today what God has reserved for tomorrow when he brings that about. And so it means that you and I are stuck in a world right now where there's Parkinson's and cystic fibrosis and Zellweger syndrome and car accidents and tornadoes. And we live in a world that is very broken because of sin. And so when something bad happens, rather than saying, I'm so mad at God, maybe we should start saying, I am so mad at sin.
Yeah. All right, I told my sister when I found out about her daughter, my niece, I told her, I didn't give her any pat little greeting card sayings to help her feel better or anything. I just told her, you know what? I talked to God, and I told God, this is lame. You know, quite frankly, God, and I know you already know this, but I just have to express it to you. This is lame, and I want you to know that I think it's lame, and I know that you think it's lame, too. And doggone it, I can't wait until all this lameness is gone because it really bugs me. And when I look back on that conversation now that I had with God after I found out that my niece had cystic fibrosis, going through your book, I realized that my approach to some of this was different because I realized I wasn't really blaming God for anything, as I did in my younger days, unfortunately. But what I was really sharing with God was, hey, guess what, God? This is lame. And really, as I think about it, you know, God was just agreeing with me. Yeah,
absolutely.
Son, it is lame. I feel your pain. I'm sorry. Yeah. It is lame. Someday this will all be made better. And in the meantime, I'm there with you. And as I thought about it, I really found that comforting to realize that God would agree with me. The other thing I want to touch on, we're running out of time, and I got lots of stuff I want to get through. So, the other thing I want to talk about was when you talked about Peter, when he rebuked Jesus, telling Jesus, oh, no, you're not going to go to the cross. You're not going to suffer. That's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That was another point where I kind of got slapped upside my head because I have caught myself at times saying, well, surely God wouldn't do something like this, or surely God couldn't allow something like this. And the way you phrase that basically when we say things like that, we're kind of like Peter pulling aside God and rebuking him. And explain a little bit why you use that illustration and why we really shouldn't be going around saying, surely God couldn't do that.
Yeah. Well, I use that because when I talking about the time, that in-between time for me and David when we were waiting for those test results to find out whether or not that child I was carrying would have Zellweger or not, because what was interesting is we only told a handful of people that I was pregnant, mainly because I didn't want my son to find out until we could give him the whole picture, telling him which way it was going to go. And so we hardly told anybody, just a handful of people, and really godly people, you know, people who know and love the Scripture. And what was so interesting was how many of them, their response to us was kind of an automatic, oh, well, this child is going to be healthy because God would never expect you guys to go through. He would never put you through that again. Mm. You know, he's not like that. God would never do that. And I just remember when people would say that, I would just be kind of mystified because I just kind of thought, well, who says that God only gives us, you know, one dose of suffering, you know, and that once we've somehow paid our dues, that then we're somehow get off scot-free? I mean, that's an American version of Christianity, for one thing, because, no, you know, when you think about believers throughout history and around the world, they certainly didn't think, okay, well, I've done my one dose of suffering, so now God won't ask me to do anything else hard.
Yeah, that's true.
That's just ridiculous. But as I thought about, you know, those people that were saying that to me, what I realized was that they loved me. And they couldn't bear to think that I'd have to go through that again, you know. So it wasn't a theological response, I don't think, as much as a relational response, that they just didn't want me. They couldn't bear the thought that we would go through that again. And so I relate that in the book to Peter when, you know, Peter's just had this amazing experience of Jesus saying, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter says, "I believe you're the Christ, the Son of the living God." Whoa! And Peter's like, "Way to go, Peter. You know, on that confession, on what you said, I'm going to build my church on that."
Mm-hmm.
And then almost before he can turn around, then Jesus goes on to say, "Now, you need to understand that we're going to go to Jerusalem, and I'm going to be arrested and put on trial, and I'm going to be crucified on a cross." And, you know, for you and I, that is a very distant thing. But for the people, you know, Jewish people in that day, they'd seen people on crosses.
Mm-hmm.
They'd walked by them agonizing on a cross. And so for Peter, the idea that his beloved Jesus was going to be put on a cross, this man that he knew was so innocent, I mean, he was just like, so his immediate response is, "Don't say that, Jesus. Don't even say that. May it never be." And I think you and I can understand why he would say that. I think he said that for the same reason my friend said to me, "Oh, don't worry, this child's going to be healthy. God would never ask you to do that again." You know, I think Peter was thinking, Jesus, God would never ask you to die on a cross. And yet we know that that's exactly why Jesus came. And that was exactly the plan of God. And so I think, you know, that you and I, you know, when something is happening, that we can't make the assumption that God is not calling us to turn our face toward the cross. You know, I think we have to say, just like Jesus' response to Peter was, "Get behind me, Satan. You have in mind the things of men and not the things of God." He was basically saying, You're thinking through things in a really human level, and you're not thinking the way I think. You're not valuing what I value. You don't have the same purpose and goals that I have in my coming. And Jesus intended, he came to earth to go to the cross, so he didn't want to turn away from it. He was turning toward it. And he was kind of, you know, I'm not here for my own comfort. And neither is Jesus here solely for our comfort. He's headed to a cross. And quite frankly, you know, he says, "Follow me. If you want to be my followers," this is what he said right after that, if you want to be my follower, then you need to take up your cross and deny yourself and follow me.
I don't think we think through exactly what that entails most of the time. It just sounds like good Christianese to say that.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But you know what? It's saying you're going to have to die to your dreams about what's going to make your life good.
Hmm.
That's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a big one.
You know, there are lots of things you and I think we must have to be happy. You know, I talk to a lot of women who lose a child, and they'll ask me a question like, "So, you know, how can I ever be happy again if I don't have a child?"
Hmm.
And oftentimes I respond, you know what? We don't want there to be anything in our lives that we say, "I must have this to be happy."
Yeah.
That's called idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
What we want to say is, "Jesus, if I have you, I have everything I need. And there's nothing beside you that I need. And I believe you can satisfy me and sustain me. And I will love you, and I will serve you, and I will believe that you are good, even if you ask me to lose what is most precious to me. I mean, that's the kind of commitment that Jesus was calling for.
That's and pretty heavy.
And it sounds like a tall order for
yeah.
us, doesn't it?
Yeah,
well,
sure
it
does.
Sounds like a superstar version of Christianity, and it's really, that's normal Christianity. Right, it is.
That's so good to hear, though. We need to hear that's what normal Christianity is.
That's what the call is,
yeah.
You know, to treasure him more than anything. But here's the great thing, yo. It's not up to us to work that up. You know, I don't have to work up that kind of super faith. You'll remember there's another chapter in the book where Jesus responds to Paul, who has this thorn in the flesh.
And yeah, I was going to ask about that next.
To take it away, yeah. And what he says to him is so significant because he doesn't say, I'm going to take the thorn away, but he says, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. And what he's saying is, you know what? I'm not going to relieve the pain. I'm not going to take it away, but I'm going to be enough for you in it.
Mm.
I'm going to sustain you to endure the pain that I don't take away. And also, when he says, my grace is sufficient, he's saying to you and me, yo, I'm going to give you the grace you need so that you can keep trusting me and believing that I am good even when these hard things happen in your life. Even when I don't answer your prayers the way you want me to, just like he didn't answer Paul's repeated request to have that thorn taken away. When I don't answer your prayers the way you want me to, my grace is sufficient for that. Meaning, I will enable you to keep from becoming bitter and hard toward me. I'll give you the grace to keep trusting me and finding me in new ways in the middle of that hardship.
You know, and that's not really what we want to hear. What we want to hear is that God's going to take all the pain away, that
yeah.
he'll wave his magic wand and make everything better instantly, that there won't be any work to it. And that we'll go skipping tra-la-la through the land of candy and chocolates with Jesus as our guide. And
well, the good news is that whatever he allows us to experience, he is doing it for ultimate good. He's going to do some good things in our lives here and now. But what's even better, and this is what takes eyes of faith. I mean, faith is believing in what you can't see, right?
Right.
And so, you know, we can't see eternity. And yet, the scripture tells us that our sufferings now are earning us a weight of glory. He calls our sufferings now light and momentary. So try to picture this in terms of the metaphor he's using, something light like a feather.
Yeah.
And you and I might go, wait a minute. You're going to call the loss of two children light like a feather, light and momentary, or cystic fibrosis, or excuse me?
Yep.
But what he's saying, he's giving us perspective. He's putting it in perspective in comparison to this weight of glory that's awaiting us on the other side. Now, it's not there for us just because we've suffered. That weight of glory is there for the suffering that we've chosen to trust God with.
Hmm.
The suffering that we've persevered through and that we have, not that we've welcomed in and celebrated.
Right.
I'm not saying that, but that suffering that we've said, okay, God, you know what? I'm yours. And if you've allowed this in my life, you've got a purpose in it. And I don't want to miss that purpose. I don't want to just experience suffering and have it be wasted pain. If you have done this, you have done it for a purpose. You have a good purpose in my life. You want to help mature me. You want to put your character on display for the world. There are so many good things you want to do through suffering. You want me to learn by experience the joy of what it's like to find out that my faith is for real. That's a good gift you want to give me. And so I'm not going to shush away those good things that you want to do with my suffering. I want to open myself to them to the degree that I say, okay, God, if you've got a good purpose, then accomplish it.
Yeah.
Don't let me keep only throwing myself into praying my suffering away so that I experience it, but it doesn't do its work that you intended it to do in my life. That's what we don't want to do, yo.
Yeah.
We don't want our pain to be wasted. And when all we do is fight against it, it can become wasted. When it is not wasted is when we submit to it in that sense of, okay, God, you've brought it into my life, so do something good with it in me and through me that will bring you glory and will be for my ultimate good.
I think talking about this is so good because we hear a lot about the healing power of God, how God is a God of miracles, that he still works miracles today, that he still heals today, that the Holy Spirit is still moving in mighty ways today. And all that is absolutely true, and yet we also know that there is a reality that we talk less about, that sometimes those things don't happen. Then we're left wondering, what about all those sermons I heard about the healing power of God, the miraculous power of God, how God loves me so much that he is going to speak into my life and intervene on my behalf because he cares about me, that my foot won't strike a stone, and so on and so forth. We hear a lot about that, and yet I think all that you bring to the table is the balance to those dark moments, those dark questions that we don't want to ask out loud, lest people think, you know, around us, they don't have very much faith. Listen to mm-hmm. what they're asking. They need to read their Bible more. They, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to encourage people, ask the tough questions. God can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And your faith can handle it. Don't be afraid of looking suffering and grief face on, head on, and asking, how is God using this? Where is God in this? Ask those tough questions. You might be surprised at the answers that you'll find. And, you know, Nancy, one of the things I kept thinking about when you're talking about is, you know, some people might be thinking, well, she lost two children. That's real grief and suffering. You know what? Whatever it is that you're facing, be it a broken friendship or the loss of a child, that grief is real to you.
Absolutely.
And we need to find answers in those times of grief. Whatever the cause may be, you know, there's no saying that's more severe than something else. Whatever it is that's caused you grief or suffering, you can find answers in the comfort of God. May not be the answers that you want, but they'll be good answers. And Nancy, we're fresh out of time, which is a shame because I have like a whole half a page of stuff I wanted to get into. We didn't even get into my really good, deep theological parts of all this.
Oh, boy.
I had some.
I think maybe I'm glad. I think that would have stumped me.
Nah, I don't think it would have. It would just been fun to talk about it. Like, we didn't need to come to a conclusion. I just wanted to discuss. Your book brings up so many good questions that so many people are afraid to ask. And yet, I think what I found by reading your book and talking to you is just the fact that you ask the question and take some time to think about it and explore it and talk about it is good. Whether or not you find the answer you're looking for, the very act of exploring and pressing into God to find those answers is a good thing.
But he will reveal himself to you.
Yeah.
I mean, he promises that those who diligently seek him, that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And the way he rewards those who diligently seek him is that he allows himself to be found.
Yeah.
And so, you know, seek him.
Yeah.
And he will be found. He might not answer all your questions to your liking, but he will reveal himself to you in a way that will cause you to worship him. And that in itself is, isn't that the goal of life?
Well, it's the goal of the Christian life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Nancy, real quick, is there a website that you have where people can find out more info about you?
Sure, they can go to nancyguthrie.com. So
okay.
It's just nancyguthrie.com.
All right. Well, Nancy Guthrie, author of the book Hearing Jesus Speaking to Your Sorrow, which has been a very comforting book to me in the past after some of the stuff I've gone through recently. But thank you so much for sharing your time, Nancy. I really appreciate you sharing your story and sharing your insights. I'm bummed we didn't have like 2 hours to go through this because we could have gotten to some really good territory.
Thank you. I've loved being with you. Thanks so much.
You bet. Well, that's it for tonight's Raw Talk. Thanks so much for joining us. I have no idea what we're doing next week because I got fried out in the sun at the Albuquerque Christian Children's Home. I haven't really gained all my higher cognition functions yet, but you can be rest assured it's going to be fun, as Raw Talk always is. And I hope you guys have a shway evening in the Lord.
Thanks for joining us on Raw Talk on M88. Get the podcast of tonight's show free at m88.org. And join us again next week for more Raw Talk on M88.